This is A Confused Heap of Facts, the podcast where we have a discussion about history with the faculty of the Department of Military History and the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Department of the Army, Department of Defense, or U.S. government.
Thank you for having me.
And we have another entry today in our reassessing series, and we will be reassessing a French general and marshal and later surprise king of Sweden, Jean-Baptiste Bernadotte. So given that this is one of my specialty areas, I will turn the hosting over to Dr. Nance.
Okay, so let's start off with kind of the basic questions of, first off, who is this guy and what do we kind of know about him so far? So let's start off with, who is Field Marshal Bernadotte?
Yeah, so briefly, he is a soldier of fortune. He's an NCO in the old Royal Army who makes good in the Revolution, becomes a division commander, gets wrapped up in politics. He's named one of Napoleon's marshals. We'll talk about his record as a marshal because that's where a lot of the criticism comes in. And then he is, as I mentioned, surprisingly made King of Sweden, and officially becomes King of Sweden after the wars, but effectively in around 1810. And that's where he ends his life, and we'll circle back to that point because it's an important part of who he is as a person. But the kind of the book on him, and Dr. Bernard, you can weigh in on this too. I think it's fair to say there are kind of two conclusions people come to about him, and he is the hated marshal. There are very few pro Bernadotte people left, so it's worth saying that. So one of the reasons is, he messes up spectacularly a couple times. One of them, notably at Jena and Auerstedt, which we'll talk about. And then again in 1809, which is far more ambiguous. And then the other thing people dislike him for, and you find this a lot among kind of the nationalist crowd in France, is that he's a traitor, because he is put on the Swedish throne, not by Napoleon, but with Napoleon's assent. Napoleon wants him to be a loyal, however you want to say it, ally, vassal. And Bernadotte does the opposite. He is one of the three army commanders who defeats Napoleon, although Bernadotte's not directly involved in that for most of the war. But again, we'll talk about it. So you have these kind of two pillars of the Bernadotte is bad camp. He was incompetent as a commander, and he betrayed Napoleon.
Well, and I just want to say that these narratives come out in the historiography very early after the Napoleonic period. So as part of the 19th century, wider Napoleonic studies are produced in the 1820s and 1830s. This narrative of incompetence and betrayal is already baked into the story.
And in large part by people who fought with and next to Napoleon. That's a big point. We'll come back to that later.
That's actually one of the questions I wanted to start with. Like, so as this narrative is being formed, how do we know about Bernadotte? Where are the sources coming from?
Yeah, I mean, it's like anybody from the period. By the time you get to the late 18th century, documentary sources are pretty good. We're not sure on literacy rates, but we're probably edging maybe 50% literacy. Now, bear in mind, when we say literacy, we're not talking like reads Voltaire. We're talking can read and write, basic reading and math. So we have pretty good sources for somebody like Bernadotte. He is from Pau in the south, in what used to be called Bayarn. It's up in the Pyrenees, the same place Henry IV was from. And so I think one of the things that kind of irked him was he was never going to be the favorite son of his hometown because King Henry IV was. But we have pretty good records. His family is, they're notable enough to show up in things like baptismal registries. And then, of course, once he joins the army, there is no institution better at generating paperwork than an army. And that's true even as far back as, the time he joined in the 1780s. So we have a ton of records from that period. We have a ton of records from the Napoleonic period. He took a lot with him to Sweden. In fact, a lot of the records I look at in the old regime are actually donations of the Swedish monarchy in the 1850s and 60s to the war ministry back in France. So he took some stuff with him. So the documentary sources are pretty good for, you know, archival primaries. And then the other thing that happens is, as Dr. Bonura mentioned, there's a huge market for Napoleonica, both during his life and especially once he dies, once the wars are over, once France kind of starts to look nostalgically back at him, once people like Germaine de Staël, you know, the arch-republican, dies, and, you know, she carried a lot of water for Bernadotte. We'll talk about that later. But once a lot of those debates kind of settle out, there's this kind of pan-French nationalism that wants to read about the marshals, about the campaigns. It doesn't hurt that some of them live a long time, like Marmont, Oudinot. Soult is the war minister in the 1850s. So there's a lot on the market, and there is no bigger market for popular history than Napoleonic military history in France in the 19th century.
And in particular, a lot of Bernadotte's peers produce memoirs,
mm-hmm.
right? The memoirage in this period is fantastic, and that's where you get a lot of the analysis concerning character and, mm-hmm. right, traitor, betrayal, incompetent. It's not this passionless military history. It is very much, I've been personally wronged, I fought with him, and he was an incompetent.
And there's two other sources that I think people don't pay enough attention to. We don't do this much now, but it was very common to have journals published, even during the lifetime of the person who wrote them. So when you got mail was not private. When you got a letter in the 18th and early 19th centuries, you read it and then you passed it around to your friends. You might be sitting in a salon, you might be at home. And the journal of somebody like Talleyrand, who wrote this kind of memoir/journal. It's 5 volumes. It's an incredible chronicle of the period. Bernadotte is all through it. Thibault, another officer who's fairly high ranking in the Napoleonic army, is kind of the same thing, a journal/memoir. The other source, which if a researcher wants a project, there is a semi-official military journal called The Military Spectator in France. It runs from the, I think, 1826 until 1914, for reasons that are hopefully obvious. This is the journal where the Napoleonic officers fight with each other. That's the kind of place where a Bernadotte features prominently. Now, I will say, to my knowledge, there is nothing done on that in English.
So what we have, just so that we can have a baseline understanding, is we have the documentary / archival evidence of the army, his biographical stuff, all that's very easily verified. The army records, which are, again, very easily verified, mostly just the facts, ma'am, although there's some...
Yeah, those are housed in what's called the Depot de la Guerre.
And then the kind of the first cut analysis is from the actual participants themselves.
Right.
So as we take a look at initial evaluations of this individual, those are from people who knew him and served with him and were around at the contemporaries.
And remember, many of them lived long after the wars. Jomini doesn't die until 1869. He knew Bernadotte. Soult, as I mentioned, lives until the 1850s. I think Marmont does too, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So it's a couple generations before you really get to the true point of memory. By that time, the camps are set. There's a pro-Bernadotte that's fading, and there's a really strong anti-Bernadotte sentiment.
Okay, this is just interesting because to me, as a World War II scholar, it's like the first cut of World War II historiography came out in the 1950s, 1960s, with the publication of the Green Books, all the memoir literature, and that pretty much cast the foundation for everything that we still look at today.
It's an exact analogy. The first cut of the operations is by Jomini. Everybody uses it. Clausewitz uses it. Jomini was the head of the history section of the Napoleonic Grand Staff. So
okay.
He's doing the exact same things that the U.S. Army historians are doing in the 50s and 60s.
Okay, perfect. So we've kind of established the sourcing and where we're getting all this information from. So you mentioned he's an NCO in the Royal Army?
Yeah, so he joins the Royal Army. Nobody really knows why. It's always hard to tell. One of the great misfortunes of the 18th century is that the voice of the common soldier is absent. I'm aware of no memoir of a common soldier from the period. So we assume it's the normal things. He didn't want to go into the family trade, which was kind of government law work. He may have been looking to get out of town, although he didn't go very far.
So he's a middle class.
I'd say
as
lower
we
middle
understand
class.
Okay.
If you're familiar with Clausewitz's background, basically the same thing, except his father wasn't military. Very, very common for people to enlist from that kind of background. In fact, both urban and rural, by far, the largest group of people who enlisted was the lower middle class, the children of artisans and low-level government workers, those kinds of people. He joins it's kind of a specialty unit, and I won't get into the details of the Royal Army, but it's not a line infantry unit. It's essentially attached to the Marine, which is the Navy. It also runs the colonies. And he quickly develops a good reputation. He is known as Sergeant Belle Jambe, which means good legs. That means two things that are really important for his legacy. One, Bernadotte was always tall, and everyone said how good-looking he was. There are many, many accounts of people walking into a room and saying, "Who is that man? I need to know who he is." And that lasted till the end of his life.
Sometimes it helps to look the part.
Right. And the other thing was, he was, by all accounts, a master of discipline, but not in a way that was negative. It seemed like he paid a lot of attention to detail, and his troops were always the best disciplined around him. And this continued on campaign. His troops are noted for not looting a lot, and again, not in a way that makes him a martinet. I've never read anything that shows that he was the kind of discipline and punish type sergeant.
So, Dr. Monroe, I'll ask you this question more as you put on your other hat for a minute, your other green hat. So how do we get how does a leader enforce discipline to the point that they're the best at it, yet somehow not be known as a martinet? The two seem contradictory, right?
Well, I think, and this is the multifacets of Bernadotte's character, right? He clearly seems like he's directly engaged, right? So this is going to be much more leading by example than what is normal for the period. And honestly, and this will come out in his history, he's not, unlike a DeVue, who is the Iron Marshal, and while also not a martinet, but far more physical and direct in his discipline.
Some of his soldiers did not like him.
That's right. Bernadotte is not asking his soldiers to march 100 miles in a day and fight a battle at the end of it, right? Bernadotte is... The other way you show that you care about your soldiers is putting them in good positions and not abusing them by order and mission. And I think that's, you know, I would say that's what Bernadotte kind of gets as a reputation, as much as you can access a reputation with the men from this period because of the lack of source material.
Right. And this does continue through the Napoleonic period. But two, if your listeners are familiar with kind of a sports analogy, Bernadotte is the player's coach, which has many, many advantages, but it can have disadvantages too. As we'll talk about later, he axiomatically moves slowly. That's not always true, but it's true most of the time.
Okay, so he is a popular non-commissioned officer, seems to, and I'm assuming also tends to get results from what I...
He's an NCO in a time of peace. So results mean his troops are well-drilled and disciplined, they're not causing problems with the locals, he can transfer to a new unit and be okay, and he can build relationships with the incoming colonel. In the old regime army, who your colonel was and what your relationship with him was literally everything. It determined where you would go, it determined what societies you traveled in, and often determined who you married. That's an important part of Bernadotte's life that we'll get to. But he was very good at playing the kind of local game. And again, he's not gone far from Pau. I forget the exact radius, but he doesn't leave the south of France during this period. It takes him actually a while to get to Paris. I don't think he actually goes to Paris till the late 1790s. So he is one of the thousands of faceless, skilled, professional, non-commissioned officers who are the backbone of Louis XVI's army.
Okay, so, go ahead.
And this sets him up perfectly in the revolutionary period to get elected. He's one of these guys that gets elected to become an officer in the revolutionary period because of that competence.
Yes.
Because at the end of the day, soldiers want competent leaders when they are going into battle.
Mm-hmm. So let's expand on that just a little bit. So the French Revolution happens, 1789.
So interestingly, I'm gonna get you on the date there because there's a preliminary event, and increasingly historians are saying the revolution started in 1787. But there's a popular uprising in Grenoble called the Day of the Tiles. Mm-hmm. Bernadotte is one of the regiments there. His unit is there. They have carte blanche to shoot crowds if they want. Most of them don't, but they have the ability to if they want. He doesn't, and he is among the many people who pull his troops out because they don't want to fire on their fellow Frenchmen.
Is he make now? Is he still a non-commissioned officer at this particular state? So is he the one making this decision, or is this just he is part of the group that made that decision?
So I'm going to turn that question back around on you, because you have been in a situation where you are being shot at in a chaotic environment on a street in Mosul. Yes, there was a division commander making decisions for you. Who's making the decisions on the ground?
Okay, so and that's what I wanted to ask is, like, is he in a position where he's actually making decisions, or is he just executing those?
Yeah, and NCOs in the Ancien regime had a lot more span of control than NCOs we would think. It's not, there aren't as many of them in the Ancien regime as there is in an American infantry unit today.
Maybe two sergeants per regiment.
That's right. So you're talking about he's controlling and commanding is not the right word for it, but he is in charge of hundreds of soldiers at a time, depending on the situation.
He is also their social and moral leader.
So if you're talking two NCOs per regiment, this is more equivalent in a modern American context to almost like a sergeant major.
To an extent. There are no exact analogies at the NCO level, but right. It is a level of moral authority that a modern NCO may not have.
So this is not a buck sergeant E5 no. with like five guys.
He's also literate. No. He's educated. So most of his soldiers are not. And they look to him, this is a hierarchical society, right? Mm-hmm. They look to him as their natural leader. And when he and his fellow NCOs and officers back out of the city, it's a sign that, one, this is not going to be easily resolved. But two, he does have a moral clarity that I think you can trace through his life. Now, where that leads him, we'll see. But
you're also pointing out is that there's some judgment there as well.
Yes. He executes judgment as a non-commissioned officer in many cases, because he's involved in this throughout the early revolution. And in many cases, he opts for the humane answer. And the thing that tells for him, as Dr. Venera pointed out, his soldiers elect him to be an officer, and his unit remains one of the last to experience disciplinary problems as discipline starts to break down into 1790, 91, 92.
So let's look at that period a little bit more detailed. So 1787, not shooting civilians, that's a good start. And so how does he write out the early days of the revolution, and how does he go from sergeant, Bernadotte, to lieutenant or captain, you can fill in the correct rank, Bernadotte.
It changes fast. It doesn't matter so much. No, and
Officer Bernadotte.
Yeah, one of the things that people need to understand is the Royal Army breaks down quickly. There are plenty of books on this. Samuel Scott's written one. Julia Osmond has written one. The danger is the men in uniform are the same as the men and women demanding rights in the streets. And often that's literal. Like, the revolutionaries will literally reach out to their brother soldiers and say, join us, and many of them do. This is a challenge for Louis XVI when he's thinking about dispersing the crowds in 1789, after the Day of the Tiles, which is late 1789.
Not sure which way the guns are going to shoot.
Well, exactly. And there are soldiers involved in things like the storming of the Bastille and the March on Versailles and, you know, the storming of the Tuileries and all of that. Where he is basically on the frontiers, the eastern frontier, mostly on the Rhine. And he is elected the leader of whatever unit he's in. It gets amalgamated. It becomes a demi-brigade. But he goes up fast. I forget the exact promotion list, but, I mean, he's a colonel within a few years. And remember, the fighting starts in mid-1792.
So what part does he play in that early fighting? Is he a captain leading a company during this time frame, or do we not have enough detail?
Yeah, so he's involved pretty much from the beginning, and there's so much of a whirlwind with a lot of these guys. He ends up...
Is he at Valmy?
Well, he ends up for most of his career on the Rhine.
Okay.
And he stays under particularly Jean-Baptiste Jourdan, who is one of the few competent early revolutionary commanders. He goes from battalion command to division command under Jourdan. I forget the exact date, but by the time the war turns, by 94, 95, he's a division commander.
Right, and the thing with Bernadotte is he's not – so he is a combat leader. He's commanding combat troops. He's not a staff officer through this period. But at the same time, he is also dabbling into politics. Mm-hmm. He is not an apolitical officer. So from the middle 80s, he is clearly tracking with the political sentiments of the revolution. And when it happens, he is involved in these debates wherever he is. Mm-hmm. So as the revolution begins to change, his politics aren't changing, but he is politically educated and involved.
So one of the things to remember about Bernadotte, well, two things here. One, his reputation as a disciplinarian follows him. His units are always well-disciplined, and they don't do a lot of looting, which is not usual for revolutionary units. Also, as Dr. Benura points out, he never ceases, prior to about 1810, to be a committed Republican. He is all in on the Republican cause. I wouldn't call him a Jacobin, although he is tarred that way.
I was going to say, he does that, yes. But you can see it, his opponents are tarring him that way for a particular reason.
And he does, I will say, he aligns himself with Jacobins later. We'll talk about the mess that happens later. But for the early years of the fighting, he's involved in the frontline fighting, like I said, as he goes from the equivalent of battalion to division command in Germany. And what we see in Germany happen is something that, there's a biography of him by a writer named Palmer, and he has this great line. The first time we see this happen is in the 1790s, that Bernadotte is always around great events, but he rarely participates in them. So there's a big battle, I believe it's at Würzburg, fairly early in the war. And it's one of the early kind of signal battles that the revolution can, you know, it can fight. Bernadotte has a unit outside he's not in proximity. He's supposed to be there, but the weather's bad, he doesn't make it, and the battle is fought and won without him. This is something we'll see throughout his career. It's not always true, but the line that he is always around great events but not participating in them is we start to see that emerge in these battles in the early 1790s.
Okay, so now with his politics, just to kind of finish this line of thought, is it more pragmatism? Because during that time frame, to not only succeed but one might argue to survive, you kind of have to have a certain penchant for politics, or is this actually a true believer?
So in my research, and I am not a Bernadotte scholar, but it is easy to lay on to the revolutionary period pragmatism and opportunism. Mm-hmm. because there's a lot of elements of that, but don't discount the revolution's ability to make true believers. Mm-hmm. Bernadotte is a true believer. The general I studied, François-Étienne Kellermann, he's not a Republican, but a revolutionary, right? He believes in eliminating, the power of the church, right? So when he goes to Spain, he's very involved in church sermons and all of the
desacralization.
Yes, right. The Fraternité, Liberté, Égalité. A lot of these officers really become believers.
Yep.
And so don't discount that. It's okay. Very easy to do so looking back.
And there's something important to understand about Bernadotte. He clearly had personal convictions, and we have letters from him that he wrote to his family. And it's clear that he is a committed Republican. Although I would certainly not say to the degree of a Kellermann or many of the, I'm doing air quotes, the Jacobins. But he is committed to that cause. On the other hand, as I mentioned, he has not yet been to Paris. He is not anyone of account. He is one of the thousands of men who served as high-ranking officers in the Republican armies. The other thing that starts to happen, though, is as he rises in authority, because he's competent, he comes to the attention of people who do have power, in particular the ultimate pragmatist, Paul Barras, who is himself a sometime general. But Barras is always on the lookout for officers who can make Paul Barras more money and power. And he is, unfortunately, many people view, particularly the directory, the period of the revolution from 1794 to 1799, through the lens of Barras, that it's this corrupt kleptocracy, it's just, people on the take. It is that, but there's more. So Bernadotte gets kind of vacuumed up into Baha's sphere of influence. And I would say at this point, by, you know, around 1795, I would say he is a fairly naive Republican idealist.
About how old are we talking about during this time frame?
So he is older than many of his peers. In fact, I believe, other than Massena, he's the oldest marshal who's not honorary. So he's pushing, he's probably, 35 by this point? I think he gets his baton when he's like 41 or 42.
Okay,
so he's about 5 to 10 years older than many of his division commander peers.
So mid to late 1790s, he is a well-regarded division commander.
He is someone the government in Paris has its eye on, in particular because after Thermidor, after the Jacobins and Robespierre and all those folks are purged, there's a power vacuum. And increasingly, people realize that the army is going to play a role in the future of French politics, whether optimistically because you needed to backstop liberty, or Paul Baha, cynically, I need to stay in power and I need to purge my enemies.
Now, is he looked at more from his military cred or his political cred?
He has no political credibility for anyone except his soldiers.
But he does present as loyal.
Yes.
And that's as important as his military credentials.
So there's a really interesting thing that happens, and I don't know how much I believe it, but it's one of those stories that should be true if it's not, that he met Bonaparte, right? And they hadn't had much contact because they'd just been ships passing in the night, right? Bonaparte is not a German. There are people who fight in Germany on the Rhine. Bonaparte is not one of them, so he and Bernadotte don't. It's the same with people like Augereau. They just don't cross paths until later.
Until later.
Yeah.
Which Augereau
becomes important later.
Yeah.
But Bernadotte is somebody who he meets Bonaparte, and there's this scene where he thinks Bonaparte is this like provincial hick who's just stupid, but you know, kind of like low cunning, and they're talking about operations, and I forget which campaign it is, but Bernadotte walks away from that saying, "Wow, I need to read some Caesar." Like, he's genuinely impressed with Napoleon's erudition and understanding of military history and military affairs. Which tells us that Bernadotte hadn't dedicated himself to that. And there's this kind of whirlwind of events in the late 90s that will change all of this. But meeting Bonaparte is one of them. Bernadotte is not in the top rank of available people to be a patsy. That's what Barras wants him to be. He wants a general who will be his patsy. The top rank of those people are Pichegru, who is a sword-carrying Jacobin, although it turns pretty quickly. He becomes a crypto-royalist. Jourdan, who is a true Jacobin, to the end. And then Augereau, who is also a sword-carrying Jacobin. Augereau comes from a very humble background, and Augereau never loses that.
Okay,
Augereau's the redneck who made good.
So I want to hit on a couple things that you mentioned here. The first is, you said he's loyal.
Yep.
To whom or to what?
To the Republic.
Okay, so the reason I ask is that during this time frame, that loyalty could be to a person. So he owes us to this idea of France as an ideal. Is that a way of putting it?
Yeah, and Barras at this point in time is looking for a military leader to form, to use as part of a coup.
Yep.
To reshape the government.
Yep.
So the government or elements of the government in power want a change in power, and they're looking to co-opt the military, and that's what they're assessing the likelihood of candidates for.
And so to kind of bring this to a head, in the late 1790s, there's a series of coups. One of them purges Pichegru. Pichegru gets caught up by the kind of royalists, for lack of a more nuanced explanation. He is purged, and then Augereau becomes the man. Augereau is the guy who's going to be this spear of the Republic. The problem is, Augereau is not a patsy. He wants what he wants. Jourdan has the same problem, and Jourdan is very senior. Jourdan is like Bernadotte, somebody who came from humble beginnings, was an NCO, but he is now one of the senior commanders in the Republic. Similarly, Bonaparte, also like Augereau, has his own ideas. So now we've taken out the three leading people. And then there's Lazare Hoche, who's also involved, but he gets kind of crossways with Baha as well. And so what this is doing is clearing the decks for Bernadotte. And as he moves closer into Baha's circle, he becomes more and more somebody that they think that they can actually use as a patsy, including he will eventually marry Napoleon's former mistress, Desiree Clary.
So he is seen as somebody that, because he's loyal to the idea of the Republic, if you convince him that there's a danger to the Republic, he could fight for it.
He is often on the streets of Paris during these what are called journées, these coups that happen, Prairial, Germinal, eventually Brumaire. Although he doesn't participate in them directly. It's interesting. Like, he's there. A lot of times he's just hanging out with Talleyrand. But he doesn't go out on the street like in uniform. And his thing is, he keeps sending dispatch riders to Baha saying, if you order me to, I'll take command of the army. If you order me to, I'll take command of the army, Paul Baha. And the order never comes.
So, and then the other piece that I wanted to pull on there is he said he'd talked with Napoleon, who had some professional education, is probably the wrong word to use.
No, he did.
But had academy background.
Much more than Bernadotte.
And that was what I was asking, what I'm getting at, is that Bernadotte comes from a NCO background during that time frame. So he has a lot of practical, experience.
He has the equivalent of a fourth grade education.
And so how does that then fit him amongst his peers, as he is now... amongst other guys that some of them seem to have, some of them have that education, some of them don't. Where does that place him in that category?
So ironically enough, and this is of course one of the main criticisms of Napoleon, while Napoleon himself values education for himself, he does not particularly value it for his subordinates. Mm-hmm. And so there is no requirement, there isn't even encouragement for what we would call professional development or education, continuing education. He's looking to put the right general in the right place at the right time and doesn't care if that general is developed outside of experience, right, to be that cog in the Napoleonic machine.
So what happens with this is, and it's really interesting, Bernadotte essentially misses his chance. There is a vacuum after Pichegru is purged, after Hoche kind of leaves the scene and Jourdan is sidelined, and Jourdan is almost purged himself. After Augereau is sent to command the army on the Rhine, he is banished to get him out of the capital. And Napoleon, of course, is in Italy. And then later Napoleon goes to Egypt. But in that time, there's a vacuum. Bernadotte easily could have stepped into it, but he doesn't. And that opens the door for Bonaparte. One of the things that really frustrates Bernadotte is he wants the job, whether the job is commanding the army in Italy, for which he's qualified, or being the war minister, which he eventually does. He's eventually made war minister for like 6 weeks. It's not, you know, he doesn't do much. But by that point, by the time we get to like 1797, 1798, Bonaparte is running the government. He's running it through Baha, but he's running it. And at that point, Bernadotte gets really frustrated because he's not getting what he wants because Napoleon is now pushing the buttons.
So what's your... Let's see if this is an appropriate kind of characterization. What you're seeing is a capable, reasonably politically active, not very... perhaps bold on the battlefield to a degree, but not... not Napoleon bold.
I mean, he's not Patton, but he's not McClellan.
So what we're seeing is a very capable kind of middle tier guy.
Yeah, and not even middle tier necessarily. I would say he is perfectly capable of commanding a field army. In fact, he does, at Napoleon's behest, in the Second Coalition War, he commands the Army of the West, which sees off a British invasion and runs down a set of rebels known as the Chouans. Although to Napoleon's anger, he cannot capture their leader, a man named Cadoudal. But he does that very well. And because we know he's a disciplinarian, he does not do what Hoche did in the West, which was just wholesale murder people.
And that's what kills Hoche's career, is his activities in the Vendée.
Kills his career.
And that's the benefit that Bernadotte has with all. That's the benefit of all this discipline, is that he doesn't have any baggage
clean
from
hands. Yeah,
that's right.
So let's make that leap then. So we've got Bernadotte, who is in the upper tier of guys during the Directory, and now Napoleon comes on the scene. How does Bernadotte make that leap from
this is
very capable, yeah. reasonably capable upper tier general to now all of a sudden one of the gilded few Napoleon's.
So it's not marshals. A straight path. Bernadotte never forgave Napoleon for two things in 1799. Bonaparte is in Italy, or excuse me, in Egypt, basically on Talleyrand's, you know, wild harebrained scheme of going to conquer Egypt. He cannot take the Ottoman fortresses in Palestine, so he retreats back to Egypt. He abandons his army without orders, sneaks out of Egypt on a corvette with, like, it's a small number of people, right? It's like 10 people.
Right.
Including Davout. And he leaves the army in command of an officer named Kléber. Kléber converts to Islam and is assassinated. Those are the two things that Bernadotte never forgave Bonaparte for. And it, to me, this his anger seems genuine. Yes, Bonaparte is his rival. Yes, he does not like that Bonaparte is who he is. But Bonaparte did disobey orders by abandoning his army, and he did get a German. Kléber was a German. He was Bernadotte's old friend from the Rhine. He got him killed. Those are court-martial offenses, particularly the first one. And he is actively writing to everybody he can, Bernadotte is, to have Bonaparte court-martials. So there is an open question when Bonaparte returns to France in 1799 as to what's going to happen. Because they clearly want him to run the government, but he has this stain on him now for officers of high moral character like Bernadotte. And as I said, Bernadotte never forgave him for that. But that hesitancy comes back because Napoleon botches the coup of Brumaire in late 1800. It's a mess. It takes 2 days. He has to rely on his brother in the upper house of the legislature. At one point, he just storms the room with soldiers and uses like the three remaining senators to be declared first consul. Bernadotte is there. You could argue he is senior to Napoleon. Not necessarily in, you know, number of stars, but in date of rank. He easily could have at least tried to do something, but he doesn't. Like, he puts on civilian clothes and wanders the streets, waiting for the order to take charge of the army, yet again. So the path to the marshalate is not a straight one. In fact, he goes back to the Army of the West for a while, because that's his official position. And Napoleon sends him all of, like, three letters during that time, because Napoleon is moving to Italy to take care of the problem that will culminate in Marengo. But at this point, another rival emerges in Moreau. Moreau is another one of these generals who's a Republican, who's Napoleon's rival. Bernadotte realizes he can't do anything about Napoleon when Moreau goes to Napoleon's side. They're the three. They're the troika in late 1800. And once Moreau agrees to basically lay down for Bonaparte, Bernadotte then decides he's not going to fight him either.
Okay, so let's look at Bernadotte's now that he's in command.
Yeah.
So this Army of the West, they see off a British invasion. Well, are we talking how big of a fight are we really talking about?
So the local militia does it and the actual forces don't. This happens all throughout the wars. Nobody really cares about it because basically the British land, they get malaria, the local militia turns out, they shoot at them, and the British go away. So it's by the time you get to 1800, by the time Marengo and then Hohenlinden happen to end the war, Bernadotte is out of politics, but he's in Paris. So he is one of the people that Napoleon clearly needs to do something with, just like Moreau. Now, Moreau will take care of himself. He will leave. But Bernadotte sticks around, which is why he gets his marshal's baton.
Okay, so at this point, it's Napoleon starting to drill his army, the famous...
Where Bernadotte is not. He is not at Bologna. He is not a corps commander. And he is sent to Hanover to be the commander of the occupation there. Which is why, if you've ever seen a map of the 1805 campaign, he is not marching from Bologna. He's marching from Hanover.
Okay, so then we're now at this point. So his first major campaign with Napoleon is the 1805 campaign.
Yep.
Well, now he had been a division commander in the Army of Italy in 1898.
Right.
So Napoleon does have a relationship with him as a subordinate, which conceivably is why he gets.
What's his performance in Italy?
He frustrates Napoleon by marching slowly. I mean, that's the end of it.
But does yeoman's work? Yes, he's not as fast as some of his peers, which will dog him for his entire career. But in Italy, he follows orders. He's not resisting. He's not you know, going off on crazy tangents.
Not trying to duel people.
He's right. He is following orders and doing a reasonable job.
He's a steady, middle-of-the-line kind of guy.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he is. You wrote a book on William Simpson in World War II. He's that kind of officer. If Simpson had, you know, written a few letters about politics, like maybe thought about running as a candidate for president in 48.
So steady, reliable division commanders at this point.
Yeah, division, and I would say if you gave him a field army, he'd do okay with it.
Okay. So 1805 campaign. Well, how does he do?
I would say he does fine. He marches south with a kind of combined Franco-German unit that becomes a German unit pretty fast. He vacuums up the Bavarians. He's involved in the surrounding of the Austrian army at Ulm. He's involved in the pursuit up the Danube Valley that culminates in the Battle of Austerlitz. And I think Austerlitz is arguably his finest hour as a corps commander.
Yes.
If you want to detail what he does there.
Yeah, so at Austerlitz, he is on the left flank of the French position. And ostensibly, his main job is to keep one of the Russian elements isolated from the rest. Because Napoleon's plan here is to, as he often does, is to penetrate through the center and then attack, you know...
one side.
Yeah. Encircle one side.
Yeah, Bernadotte is basically plugging the gap that Soult opens as Soult swings to the south.
Yeah, and so Bernadotte does two things that are important. He detaches a division on his own initiative to help Soult move, and that's important because it's a tricky... attacking up the Pratzen Heights and helping Soult early is critical. And when Napoleon orders him to occupy the Pratzen Heights and defeat the last remaining Russian... discipline force, the Imperial Horse and Foot Guards, he does an excellent job doing it.
Mm-hmm. Although he is criticized for not pursuing them fast enough, which honestly is kind of a specious criticism.
Right. Why is it specious?
It's specious because the idea that a pursuit is even possible, much less effective, is something Clausewitz would say is war on paper. Pursuit after a battle is extremely difficult because you're talking about getting together an army that has just fought and throwing it across the countryside faster than an enemy army can run away. And soldiers, when they're scared, run really fast.
So he succeeded in his initial tactical task of fix. He then was in a follow and support.
Exercised mission command effectively.
He did.
And then when he saw that he had to change the plan a little bit in order to achieve the commander's intent, was able to do so.
Absolutely. Which is the standing order to any Napoleonic subordinate, do what you think is best.
And in Austerlitz, he does that.
Yep.
He's 100% supporting Napoleon's idea and making it happen.
He proves at Austerlitz that he deserves the Marshal's baton.
Yeah.
The problem is what happens after.
Okay, so Austerlitz happens.
War of the Third Coalition ends. However, he had started the next war because he had been ordered by Napoleon to transit the Prussian exclave of Ansbach in 1805 to march faster. That is the pretext by which the Prussians join the Allies, technically before the War of the Third Coalition ends, in late 1805, beginning the War of the Fourth Coalition, where Bernadotte perhaps does the worst.
Okay, so let's talk then. So he goes from the shining moment where he does a good job at Austerlitz.
I would say he did a great job.
Yeah.
Although the problem with at Austerlitz is that there's a lot of great jobs that happened on that day.
Yeah, it was Napoleon's masterpiece for a reason.
Who went up the center?
Soult, Lon, Murat, Bernadotte, all of them deserve.
They make the best possible decisions at every point in the battle, and it all works the way it's supposed to.
Everybody had their best day.
Yes.
This time the Russians had their worst day.
Except Bézier, who didn't do much.
Well, right. Right.
Okay, so now we're moving on to the Fourth Coalition. At this point, we're predominantly fighting the Prussians. The Russians are coming, but they're...
Yeah, the Russians are far away.
They're like dragons. They're coming eventually.
So what happens is Napoleon's army spread across Germany. They march north. Napoleon's orders are a mess. He doesn't know where the Prussians are. He thinks they're going to be to the east. They end up being further west. The Prussians are also a mess. They have no idea what they're doing. So you have two armies blunder into each other around Jena and Auerstedt in Saxony. And originally, you will read all kinds of authors say that Napoleon had this elaborate march order system that they'll usually call the Bataillon Cahay, which is a joke. The Bataillon Cahay is a march exercise. But in reality, he's just throwing corps forward, and he's basically telling them to conduct, you know, recon by fire.
One engages, then one sees.
Right. So Bernadotte is at the front. He's at the north, and he's expected to be the advance guard for the army. Once they contact the Prussians further to the west than they thought, Napoleon blunders into a fight at Jena, a battle that Ney almost loses for him by advancing without orders. But it's only like a third of the Prussian army. It's about 30,000 men.
If I recall correctly, it's actually their rear guard.
It kind of. Again, the Prussians are also a mess. And Bernadotte ends up on not the far flank, the far right of the French, because Davout had outmarched him, shockingly. And Davout was now the right flank. Davout ends up fighting most of the Prussian army as it retreats from Jena at Auerstedt. Davout's corps beats a disorganized Prussian army by itself, including Blücher's worst hour, where he sends echelon cavalry at Davout's squares, and they get shredded. Bernadotte is between both battles. He can hear both battles and goes to neither. And again, this is the knock on Bernadotte. He's always around great events, but he doesn't seem to participate.
Now what? Oh, go ahead.
Now, having said that, this is not the first Napoleonic battle where a corps has received conflicting orders, vague orders, or no orders, and not engaged either way. And I'm thinking Waterloo with Darolan's corps
right. Is
in the same kind of position. He's between two very important actions. If he had taken part in either one, it would have been amazing. Mm-hmm. He does neither.
Now, and so there's something important here that happens too, and it's part of the anti-Bernadotte case. Bernadotte becomes the foil for Davout, explicitly at Jena-Auerstedt, but implicitly throughout their careers. Davout is arguably the best of the marshals, and the Florida State crew is going to get mad about Massena, but Davout is very good. Davout is... or was a committed Jacobin who then becomes a committed Bonapartist. But he wasn't somebody who mattered in politics until he got his baton. And in fact, nobody knows why he got it. But he clearly is a superior general. Before the 1805 campaign, Davout had already started spying on Bernadotte because he was suspect, right? And Davout is a master of spycraft. Davout and Bernadotte have contrasting personalities. Davout thinks Bernadotte is a parvenu. He thinks he's an incompetent. He doesn't think he should be commanding anything. Maybe commanding one of the rear area armies like Guillaume Brun, the street thug who dies in a street thug fight in 1815. And Auerstedt is the culmination of it. There's a legend that Davout tried to fight Bernadotte after the battle and Napoleon stopped them. I would tend to lend some credence to that story because it checks out, even if it's not true. And so for the anti-Bernadotte crew, Bernadotte explicitly is not good because he's not Davout.
Now,
which is a hard standard to meet, but there is something to it.
And the question I have too is that did Napoleon actually send written there? I remember seeing that Napoleon told Bernadotte you need to come this way, and then Davout sends hey.
So
help.
Let me correct you slightly. Napoleon doesn't issue orders. Berthier issues orders, at least at this point. So Berthier had sent orders, and the orders were delayed to Bernadotte. And what Bernadotte does basically is he gets orders essentially to support Davout. He hates Davout. It's very clear he doesn't want to support Davout. So he defaults to an earlier set of orders that basically tell him to occupy this stretch of ground and see what happens. And he continues to occupy it as Davout is almost killed by the Prussians. So I would say it's a mixture of personal animus and his default setting, which is wait for orders.
Yeah, and also, so we talk about why doesn't this end his career? Because there's conversation about Napoleon almost court-martials him and doesn't blah, blah, blah. In this case, having an uncommitted corps available immediately for the pursuit helps the French cause in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So while, yes, he failed on the battlefield, he ends up regaining some of that reputation in the pursuit.
Yeah, in the pursuit, he throws himself at the Prussians. He actually takes Blücher's surrender, the last major Prussian field force, in 7 November 1806.
Yeah.
So he redeems himself a little bit in the pursuit.
So with apologies to Napoleonic scholars, he blunders into success?
To some extent. He is, again, he is a perfectly capable division corps commander. It's just sometimes he doesn't make the right decision. Okay. And I will say, in his prosecution, nobody had clear orders on the day of Yan and Auerstedt. DeVue had no orders, and he knew what to do. Bernadotte had orders and didn't execute them.
So after Yan and Auerstedt, he doesn't really pop up very much. What happens after that?
We're going to speed forward a couple years. So he's not actually involved in the follow-on campaigns. He ends up in a position that's not in the lead for the three battles that follow at Pultusk, Eylau, and then the culmination of the war at Friedland.
Which in this case follow his traditional pattern of, right, he's in the Polish campaign, but not at any of the battles.
Right. He's just like hanging out in Warsaw or whatever.
It's good to be in his corps then.
He gets to Tilsit late, and he sees the treaty negotiations. He'd been in treaty negotiations himself. And then it's weird. He kind of disappears. There's a period of peace, and he just goes back and, probably does some reading. And then he pops up again in 1809. And this is the thing that will finally get rid of him, at least from the battlefield. Mm-hmm. So he's given another corps command in 1809. I believe it's 11th Corps.
It is made up of
Saxons.
That's right.
So the Saxons form a core of Napoleon's army in 1809. Remember, a chunk of his forces in Spain, including many of his experienced commanders. So Bernadotte gets this Saxon core, and he keeps asking for French, French reinforcements as backbone, and he doesn't ever get them. And he is thrown into the fight at Wagram, which is the big battle that ends 1809. Napoleon's already lost at Aspernessling. Bernadotte wrote to his brother that he found Napoleon happy after Aspernessling, which I don't believe because his best friend Lon had been killed.
Was Bernadotte at the Ratisbon sequence, or was he late to that as well?
So the Ratisbon cycle is essentially the DeVue, Massena,
That's
Lon
right.
show.
That's right. Yeah. Bernadotte's not there yet.
Remember, he's in Saxony, right?
He's coming.
Right.
He's coming.
He commands a second rank force that's coming to the fight. He's thrown into the fight with his Saxons, who are not French troops. They are not drilled and trained and experienced. They don't have the NCOs and junior officers that the French have. And he is put at the front of the line next to Massena on the second day of the fighting at Wagram. And his corps gets shredded. I think they have 30% casualties. And they're essentially pushed back in disorder. And Napoleon supposedly finds him retreating without orders and cashiers him on the battlefield. Now, that's a legend. We know that's a legend because he was still commanding the corps after the battle. There are letters to him as corps commander after the battle.
There's also some apocryphal retellings where Bernadotte criticizes Napoleon's generalship. Mm-hmm. And this gets back to Napoleon and is one of the reasons he gets... Mm-hmm. cashiered.
Which is not something Bernadotte had not done before. Bernadotte was outspoken about disliking the things Napoleon did and how he did them. He said them in person. He put them in writing. Those were public all the way back to the 1790s. Bonaparte didn't care. Remember, Augereau had been his rival too. Augereau was now one of his most loyal supporters. So all he needs Bernadotte to be is competent. The thing I think that finally gets Bernadotte in 1809 is the weight of the criticism from the other marshals is too much. He does not have many friends among the marshals. Jourdan, who his old boss is a marshal, ends up in Spain. Augereau, the other old Republican. But most of the marshals either don't know him or don't like him. Because not many of the Germans became marshals. That's his problem. His old Rhine buddies didn't become marshals.
Is this a case of he's not in the in crowd, or it's just they don't like him because he never seems to be at the right moment at the right time?
I think it's both. DeVue hates him because DeVue hates him. I think the other marshals recognize he may be in a little over his head. He is kind of stuffy. He's probably an introvert, right? He doesn't do court things. Even when he's king later, he doesn't really do court things. He's just, it's not his thing. He does the ritual, but he's not, he then prefers to go back to his room and read. So I think it's just that. I think he's just not, despite having been a soldier's officer, he just doesn't get along with his fellow marshals.
So at this point, Napoleon says, you're done.
Well, so to an extent, right? And I think that Ney is a good contrast here because Ney is also incompetent above a certain level. But Ney is beloved by his soldiers and his peers, until they order him shot in the face. And Bernadotte's the opposite of that, which tells you there's a personality aspect there. Bernadotte is a better commander than Ney, particularly at higher levels. And yet Bernadotte is the one who's eventually moved out. I would say at this point, it's basically mutual agreement. Bernadotte's criticisms of Napoleon in 1809 are spot on. He put a green core into a fight where it had no business being, and shockingly, it got destroyed.
Okay, so how do we get from the field at Wagram to Stockholm?
So one of the things that bails Bernadotte out is he is a in-law of Napoleon. His wife, Desiree Clary, has a sister who is married to Joseph Bonaparte. So Bernadotte is part of the extended Bonaparte family. He cannot be gotten rid of. You can't court-martial a marshal. You cannot cashier a member of your family, unless they cashier themselves, like they will in 1812.
Right. So he's hanging around. Now, during the pursuit at Jena, Bernadotte captures a Swedish division.
Yep.
And ends up, this is just serendipitous, right? He treats the Swedish officers very, very well. Mm-hmm. Of course, he treated everyone very, very well. But it just so happens that he impressed those officers who happened to be nobles, or a certain percentage of them were nobles. Mm-hmm. And they went back and had a very favorable impression of him. Mm-hmm. So that when the continental system gets imposed and Sweden is suffering, they're looking for a new monarch to get them out of this, some of the worst of the continental system tariffs, we would call them. Mm-hmm. And they stumble upon Bernadotte.
Yeah, so the way he gets here is it has deep roots, right? So back in 1806, as Dr. Minerva points out, there is no one in the Napoleonic army who has any real understanding of Scandinavia. Because they hadn't fought there, so there are no hands, as we might say, in like the 20th century U.S. diplomatic service. So Bernadotte's up there. He becomes the Scandinavia hand, and he starts kind of plugging himself into like Danish politics. And I don't think he did that with any mind other than to just be a regional expert. But it turns out, come 1810, the Swedes have a succession crisis. The vassal line has basically run itself out. There had been some coup before that. In fact, one of the kings had been assassinated. And Sweden had also just lost Finland to Russia. They lost it during the 1809 war that culminates in 1810. So they are on the lookout for a new king. They have domestic possibilities. They can maybe opt for a Dane if they want, although nobody in Sweden really wants that. But they also look to the French, and there's a party that wants a French heir because they know Napoleon will take care of them, essentially. The thing the Swedes want is Norway, because Denmark owns Norway. So the Swedes want to take Norway away from Denmark, and maybe if they can, maybe grab one of the Straits Islands, maybe even Skjelland if they can get it, which is where Copenhagen is. And he basically falls into it. Essentially what happens is a low-ranking Swedish officer, I think he's literally a captain, shows up at Bernadotte and Desiree's house and says, hey, I think you'd make a great king. And then he goes and does this, like, will it into being campaign in favor of Bernadotte. And eventually, you know, Napoleon doesn't want him to be king of Sweden because he doesn't want one of his rivals to be out of his control. But eventually they agree that he will become the prince regent. And there's all this politics in Sweden, but eventually I think it's the Riksdag,
right.
Their diet eventually votes him. Now, he's not king yet. There's still a king. He just doesn't have any children. But he is the de facto monarch.
Yeah, he's the crown prince.
Yeah, they call him the prince regent. But he's also not the commander of the Swedish military. There is a field marshal who commands the Swedish military. So he's in this weird position where he doesn't actually have any authority.
So let's skip forward a little bit just in the interest of time here.
1813.
So how do all of a sudden, like, what's his performance like when now he's flipped sides? He is now on the Allied side.
Well, so that's an interesting tale. Many in Sweden hate Russia because they want Finland back and because Russia is the giant bear next to you, right? That's familiar to Swedes today, much less in 1810. He stays neutral in 1810. What he wants is he wants a guarantee of English money and Russian support, and by support I mean a core of 30,000 men to conquer Denmark so he can take Norway away, and again maybe Skjelland. He does not get that, so he stays neutral. especially after the disaster in Moscow and the retreat. And he seems to be genuinely upset by the death in the Grand Armée in 1812. He writes several letters saying, hey, you know, my old comrades are suffering. But he understands he has new priorities now as the, you know, essentially the person running Sweden. The question is, what will he do in 1813 when the Prussians and Russians are aligned against Napoleon, the Austrians are neutral, and the other end of Europe, Sweden, they're also neutral? He needs to figure out how to get Norway, and he needs to figure out who's going to give it to him, because he knows Napoleon makes lots of promises that he never follows up on. But he also can't get anybody in the Allied camp to make him the same promise. So he's very cannily sitting out until the point at which he can profit. Eventually it comes. He's given a coalition army. What the coalition does in 1813 is they mix the national contingents so you don't have the kind of fracturing that happened in prior coalitions. And that leads us to the battlefield.
Yeah, so he gets involved. He switches from neutrality to alliance in the armistice the summer of 1813. He fields a Swedish corps of about 28,000 men and becomes in command of the Army of the North.
Which is huge. It's like 130,000.
Right. With his own Swedish corps, but a Prussian corps and a Russian corps in it. Mm-hmm. And this is, right, so the rest of the military story is he really only has command of that Army of the North in one battle, and that's the Battle of Dennewitz. He's put in charge of the defense of Berlin. So the Army of the North is protecting Berlin. Napoleon, after that summer armistice, sends Ney and Oudinot north towards Berlin. There are Marshalhead problems.
Shockingly, they're not very good commanders.
Right, either together or apart. But this is another one of these moments where Bernadotte demonstrates some real acumen. He understands the terrain. He understands the enemy. He sets the enemy up into a ambush based on the terrain. There is some restricted terrain, march routes leading to Berlin. He canalizes the French onto those routes and then sets the Prussians to stop them and maneuvers his Swedish corps onto the enemy rear and ends up, it is a very clear Allied victory. So this is the Bernadotte versus Ney and Oudinot, and Bernadotte wins.
Okay. So and in the process, gets the Prussian corps chewed up. They already didn't like him, and now they like him even less.
Which is why he never is in real command of anything for the rest of the war.
And he becomes one of the three army commanders that corner Napoleon at Leipzig, that everybody finally gets the battle they want. Shockingly, he marches slowly, and he is the last of the three armies to get there. But it works. Napoleon retreats, and then he does something very interesting. Remember, his joining of the coalition had been predicated on English money and a Russian corps for Denmark. Now that Napoleon has retreated back into France, he sees it as his national interest to send two of his corps into the Low Countries. So his army conquers the Netherlands, but the rest of it goes to Denmark, and very quickly takes care of Denmark. This is another point at which Bernadotte misses his bet. Because if you're going to create a regency in France, who might you put on the throne? He understands this. He wants it, but he's in Denmark. And by the time he gets back, in fact, he never actually makes it back into France. He ends up yet again waiting at the fortress city of Mainz for orders to come be the new ruler of France. And of course, the orders never come.
Okay, so let's kind of put a bow on him, because we can assess him as the monarch of Sweden perhaps for another day.
Yeah, and I will just say quickly, yeah. I would say, by and large, he's a good monarch. He is hampered by the fact that he does not know Swedish or Norwegian, because he gets Norway. He runs the state fairly well. He runs into problems in the 1830s when there are these movements for more independence and autonomy. And Denmark and Norway are separate states held in personal union. It's his son, Oscar, who is a linguistic savant who knows the languages, who smooths a lot of that over for him, and his son becomes his heir.
Okay, so when we started, Bernadotte was seen as kind of Napoleon's, we'll call him, slowest marshal, and in a Jennison interpretation, not amongst his top tier. Is that a valid interpretation of what we know.
So I will do my conclusions in order to give Dr. Bernier the last word. I would say he is a good division commander, even a corps commander, a sub-average marshal, and a good king. Because he's very good at keeping Sweden out of the... Like, he gives away Swedish Pomerania to avoid getting drawn into the Polish-Saxon crisis. That's a really savvy move. Now, he's compensated in other ways, largely English money, but still. He sets the pattern. Remember, he is the last person to command Sweden in a war. Sweden has not fought a war since 1814. That policy is the policy of Bernadotte. And there are no reigning Bonapartes in the world anywhere today. There are descendants of the House of Bernadotte on thrones across the world, including in Sweden. The current monarch of Sweden is the descendant of Bernadotte. So he did that part right. And who knows if he'd ever gotten the chance to do that in France. But I would say I'm on the side of seeing him as more or less the tradition, that he was just simply a bad corps commander as a marshal, for in most cases.
Yeah, and I think I would agree with that. My only caveat to that assessment is, unlike some of his peers who failed on the battlefield, Bernadotte never makes blunders on a battlefield that result in failure and retreat. His problem is he is slow, right? So he lacks the kind of cadoy of Davout to achieve great victory on his own, which doesn't put him in the top tier, but... clearly in the middle of the pack with the rest of his marshals, because he doesn't blunder on the battlefield. He makes good tactical decisions on the battlefields he makes it to. He just doesn't make it to them all.
Yeah, Bernadotte's real problem is he was born a couple generations too late and in the wrong social class. If he had been a field commander in the Seven Years' War, he would have wiped the floor with his opponents.
Yes.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
If you like this episode, please make sure to check out our other podcast, Broad Gauge Gossips, where we talk to members of the Department of Military History faculty so you can get to know them.